So the national crisis, as I've said and now a few times, I've never known our sitting group, the members of our sitting group, to be experiencing so much anxiety as I have these last weeks. And if I go beyond our sitting group into wider society, I'm even more impressed by the level of anxiety there is. And we can go through a long list of the kind of fears that people now are living under, which they weren't living under 2 months ago. And there are people, I've been told, people are bottling up on water. Very reasonable people are bottling up on water. And they wouldn't have bottled up on water otherwise, but they're now afraid of what might happen. People are sometimes afraid of, they look in the sky when there's an airplane overhead, and they wonder, what's that? Is that okay? Is that an okay airplane? People are afraid of driving across the Bay Bridges. And not only afraid of it, but I've known people who've been angry and confused and kind of despairing over the fact that they feel threatened in driving across the Bay Bridge. People afraid of flying. People afraid of their mail. A friend of mine who's a postal worker he's a postal worker up in Santa Rosa. He's quite distraught, not only about his work that he's doing, but also about his superiors, the way the Postal Service has been handling, from his point of view, his livelihood. And then people are quite afraid of the consequences of what's going to happen in the future with international crisis, that American country has a long history of being involved in all kinds of international affairs, and then having those international affairs in some way or other, sooner or later, sometimes sooner rather than later, sometimes later, come back and haunt the rest of the world, or haunt America. A long history of America of being involved internationally in ways that many years later we realized how underhanded American involvement was. And so there's a history of that, and so is the same thing happening again? Are we setting ourselves up for even greater suffering in 10, 20 years? Are we setting ourselves up so that in 10, 20 years we're going to learn the underhanded things that are actually going on in our names? I hope not, but the track record has not been that great. So people are afraid of what's going to happen internationally. A lot of fear. And then there's the economic fear that a lot of people have. And I've known people in our sitting group in the last weeks who've lost their work, people who have been threatened with losing their work, people who can't find work, they want to find work. The whole economic situation is quite troublesome for a lot of people. And so those two fears, it's not a simple addition of fears, but often when they have two fears like that, they multiply each other rather than just, simple addition of one plus one. So then the question is this new, this kind of fear? Is this kind of danger and crisis that we're experiencing, is it something new to human beings? And I don't think so. For myself, insights, or the part of the insights that come, I believe, with Dharma practice, and certainly I feel I've come with my practice, is that there's a kind of a parallel development of insight or understanding. On one hand, there's a greater understanding and appreciation of peace, of joy, of love, and the possibilities for those, the experiences of those. But it seems to be that they almost go hand in hand with a greater insight or understanding of the tremendous amount of suffering in oneself and also in the world around us. And so the question is, is it worth doing Dharma practice if you're going to have a greater insight into suffering than you had before you did it? My hope is that a healthy Dharma practice, the two go together, you actually have greater peace and greater love and compassion to hold the greater insight into suffering. It's kind of like the little saying that I've heard, I think comes from the Christian tradition, that I don't exactly remember it now, but it goes something like what is a minor irritant to a ordinary person is like a needle in the eye of a saint. that someone who's well-developed spiritually is actually much more sensitive and tuned in to suffering. One of the great shocks for me from my practice was the moment where I realized the amount of suffering in my own mind that I had been unaware of until I paid careful attention. The subtle ways in which, I was aware of plenty of enough suffering in my own life, but when I started noticing that the subtlety of the underlying kind of foundational clinging and suffering, irritation, kind of resistance and fear, that was kind of at a very, very foundational level, and just the way my thoughts worked, how I thought, how I was engaged. And then I saw that, and then I extrapolated it. I said, oh, this is just like everyone else, this kind of foundational stuff. And then I kind of was kind of shocked to realize that we have a world of billions of people with the same level of this underlying kind of wound that often goes unacknowledged, unrecognized by most of us. So let alone the suffering of war, there's a suffering of the conflict within our own hearts and minds. So there's a remarkable little discourse by the Buddha. It's remarkable because it claims to be is one of the few so-called records, probably records, of the Buddha speaking about himself, his own life, kind of biographical, autobiographical. And it talks about what he was like before he was enlightened. And it talks about the very important insight that he had as he was struggling with some of these kinds of issues himself. So he begins by saying, fear results from resorting to violence. So the consequence of violence is greater fear. And you could also say, turn it around and say violence is a result of fear, the kind of self-perpetuating cycle. Fear results from resorting to violence. Just look at how people quarrel and fight. This is 2,500 years ago. I think it's been continuous ever since. But let me tell you now of the kind of dismay and terror that I have felt. So here's the Buddha talking about his own dismay and terror. Usually we think of the Buddha after his, we have this image of him after he was enlightened, and of someone who was very peaceful and serene and calm and unfazed by anything, perhaps. But here, at least before he was enlightened, he was filled with dismay and terror that he felt over what he saw in the world around him, much like how many people feel today. Seeing people struggling like fish, writhing in shallow water, with hate against one another, I became afraid. Sounds familiar. I became afraid. At one time, I had wanted to find some place where I could take shelter. So that seems pretty familiar also. We want some place where we can find shelter, be safe. And so where are the places we look for safety? And sometimes we kind of a safety comes from knowing who to blame. If we actually know who's responsible, and there's a very clear and sharp distinction between self and other, they are to blame. Some people have an illusion, perhaps, of being safe. Or if it's very clear who's to blame, then it's easy to kind of to go out and attack that person and kind of try to just obliterate them from the face of the world, which is some of the language that's been coming out of some Americans, that we should treat someone out there with nuke. Some people in Washington use the word nuke. We should nuke them. Some people become very defensive as a result. If we just defend ourselves, shut down our borders, shut down myself, lock myself in my house, then I can be safe. So many, many ways in which we react now, looking for safety, looking for security, trying to protect ourselves or protect our family or our neighbors. So I wanted to find some place where I could take shelter, but I never saw such a place. So you'd assume that he looked around then. He tried to find something, and he couldn't find no place for shelter, no place for safety. There is nothing in this world that is solid at base, and not a part of it that is changeless. And I think this is the reason the Buddha wants to give, in his own words, at least his own view of things, why there's no shelter to be found in the world, no protection, no ultimate protection. Because nothing, none of it is solid. Everything's always changing. There's nothing which is not changeless. And because nothing is changeless, because everything is has the potential for change or is going to change sooner or later, you can't rely on it for ultimate and lasting happiness. So if you trust your government, if you trust your banks, if you trust your bank account, if you trust, there's all kinds of, you can go through the list of things that people think, oh, if I had that, then I would be safe. And it's certainly reasonable to try to create some security and some sense of well-being. But if we have this absolute dependence, if this is going to be it, once I have this, then I'll be safe forevermore, then when that is taken away, then our sense of blame and anger, confusion, despair, will get kicked up big time. But if you know that these things cannot be relied on ultimately, then perhaps there isn't quite the same surprise when the things disappear or things change. Still, it doesn't mean that you're happy about it. But there isn't the kind of existential anxiety that arises when you're actually, your whole identity perhaps was built into having it this way. One of the things I see around now, listening to people talk about terrorism in Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden, is if you listen carefully, you see how much people's self-identity are tied into what they're talking about. Part of what we do when we state our opinions is sometimes we're defining who we are. And we're trying to show people, I know, I'm smart, I'm clever, I know what's going on, this is my opinion, this is my stance. And I've heard people who are completely uninformed, seemingly, and I listen to them, not that I'm so informed, but, uninformed, come down with a very categorical opinion about how stupid those people are. How could they be so stupid to do that? It seems odd to me when you're not so well informed yourself to be judging people who are, probably much, much better informed than you. But I think part of that is because we're making a claim in who we are as a self. And if we know, if we have some understanding, then there's an existential kind of sense of security or well-being. There's nothing in this world that is solid at base and not a part of it that is changeless. I have seen them all trapped in mutual conflict, and that is why I had felt so repelled. It's a very strong language the Buddha uses. I felt so repelled. But then I noticed something buried deep in their hearts. It was, I could just make it out, an arrow. Influenced by this arrow, one runs in all directions. Having pulled out the arrow, one neither runs nor sinks. So this is the resolution of this little quote, where the Buddha feels this dismay and about this insecurity of the world and the conflict and the wars of the world. Can't find any security, which leaves you kind of just hanging. What do you do then? But then through careful insight, more careful kind of studying, what he saw was buried in the hearts of all these people who quarrel or are fighting is an arrow. And that arrow is then defined in the Buddhist tradition as being the arrows of greed, of hate, of clinging to self-identity. And it's possible then to extract that arrow. And the language that the Buddha often used for the process of enlightenment was pulling out the arrow that's in the heart. Influenced by this arrow, sometimes it's called the barb that's deep in the heart, people run in all directions. People are often looking outside themselves for security, and we run around looking for it. Having pulled the arrow out, one neither runs nor sinks. And I translate neither runs nor sinks as being, is neither agitated or depressed about how things are. So then what the Buddha then tried to teach was how to take that arrow out. And you might ask, so And the arrow resides in individuals. It's the only place it is. So then the focus, in a sense, of Buddhism tends to be on the individual, because that's where the arrow resides, and how do you get that arrow out? It's not so satisfying for everyone, because what good is it for me to take my arrow out in my own heart if there's all these people and all this violence and all these people dying and being killed halfway around the world? How does that stop the violence? I think it's a beginning. If there is no one who does that work, then the perpetual cycles will just continue on and on. And so we need to start somewhere, that process. Someone has to begin the process of clarifying their hearts and pulling out the arrows so that they don't influence us anymore. There's another verses from the Dhammapada that speak to this whole issue in very much the same way. The Buddha says, "People threatened by fear go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines." Though I guess in America we do different things, but no such refuge is secure. No such refuge is supreme. Not by going to such refuge is one freed of every suffering. But one going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the appeasing of suffering. This is the secure refuge, this is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So here the Buddha says the same thing, that people are threatened by fear. They go for refuge, and the normal refuges we seek are not ultimately satisfying, and they're not supreme, is in the language here. They're not ultimate or supreme. If you want the supreme refuge, then you go to refuge, in the Buddha's language, in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But more importantly, the whole point of doing that is you yourself can see with deep insight the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths then are understood to be the ultimate form of refuge. That's a supreme refuge which is reliable. So why is that reliable, the Four Noble Truths? And how I understand that is that the Four Noble Truths are reliable because they focus on where we know we can make a difference, hopefully. And that's a difference that we ourselves can make with the choices that we make. We're not really in charge of what happens in the world outside of us. We can try to engage that as responsibly as we can. But what happens in the external world is there's no way of having any lasting or absolute guarantee that you can change it for the better or make the world a safe place for yourself. But at least you can make your own heart a safe place. At least you can make your inner life a safe place. So that inwardly, at least, it's possible to find peace, well-being, love, and compassion. And so the story I like to use in my introductory class for this is the story when the Buddha addressed his monastics, and he said, "If a man is hit by an arrow, is that painful?" And probably the monks kind of rolled their eyes and said, "Yeah, that's pretty painful to be struck by an arrow." And then he said, "If they're struck by a second arrow, is that even more painful?" And they said, "Yes, that's even more painful." The first arrow is just what life gives you, what happens in life. You can't have any absolute control over that. The second arrow is what you add to that, how you respond to that. And how you respond to it, you have some control over. That's your responsibility. So if you stub your toe and you go and attack the rock, then you've in a sense added a second arrow. You've added your own aggression to the equation. If you attack yourself and say, "Oh, how could I have been so dumb and stupid? Every time I kind of get even close to a rock, I seem to stub my toe, and I'm the world's worst walker. Why didn't I get the right kind of walking instruction when I was 1 year old?" And suddenly we get involved in this inner world of conflict and tension and suffering, which is in a sense extra, was not required. It's possible to stub your toe and just let it be painful. It's painful enough, that's the first arrow. And we don't have to add the second arrow. And that principle, which is maybe somewhat simple to see in relationship to stubbing your toe, is meant in Buddhism to be extended out to even the most terrible things that can happen to you, things that shouldn't be happening. What is a second arrow that we add to it? And then to look at that and try to find the arrow there, that second arrow that we can pull out so we no longer agitate the whole situation, don't exasperate it more than it already is. So the first noble truth is suffering. And part of what that means in Buddhism is that there's a nobility to suffering, or there's a nobility to being present for it. There's something holy, sometimes it's called the four holy truths, something holy or sacred or noble about suffering itself. Not that suffering is good or condoned or you're supposed to search it out, but what's noble about suffering is our ability to pay attention and notice it. And to turn away from suffering, to ignore it, unless it's strategic because we need to take a break for a while and regroup our strength. To turn away from suffering tends to just add more suffering to our life. And the call of the Buddhas requires us to look very honestly and name what our suffering is. This is what's going on with me. This is what's happening. And become sensitive to where our suffering resides. Be sensitive to it in very, very, even very subtle things. So even as I was sitting here with you this morning, part of what I was being sensitive to was where the suffering was within me. And even as I was sitting here, I was getting quite calm and sometimes quite joyful sitting here. I could still aware in the corners of my being, corner of my eyes and my forehead and different places, still some subtle tension or clinging, or in my mind, a little bit of reaching out, wanting to hold on to various preoccupations and worries that I have. And I had to be very sensitive, very honest about seeing those. I didn't want to let go of them and push them away very quickly, sometimes the first tendency of many people, but to see them very honestly. And in seeing them, find the way to relax, to let go of the causes of them. So the cause of suffering then also is a noble truth. There's a nobility or sacredness in recognizing what is the cause of suffering. The definition of the cause in Buddhism is tanha. Tanha is the cause of suffering. And the word tanha in Pali means thirst, which is a very powerful kind of immediate word. And I take it to be like compulsion. When you feel compelled, when you're acting out of compulsion, when you have a desire, and it isn't just simply a nice, simple desire that floats up and you can take it or leave it, but it's a desire that has an element of compulsion built into it. You feel impelled by the desire to act on it, to have it. It has to be there. And when that compulsion is built into the desire, then it's a setup for frustration, because the momentum is to want it, and if you can't fulfill it, you're going to suffer. And even the compulsion itself has suffering within it. So that can take all kinds of forms, not just simply the compulsion of desire, but the compulsion of resistance, of anger. Is it one of these primordial or primary arrows of suffering that the Buddha talks about the important to pull out? So we say sometimes in Buddhism, are you attached? What are you attached to? And if you're suffering, to look and see, use your insight, use your ability to get calm and quiet enough to see, what is it that you're attached to? If you're attached to getting a fancy car, maybe you can see that attachment and what it does for you pretty easily, hopefully. But there's very, very difficult attachments to address. It's very hard to see some of our deepest attachments to self, to security, to our worldview. There's often a worldview that's built into our culture, as with any culture, that it becomes kind of like the air we walk through. We hardly ever see the air or notice the air, but it's always around and we depend on it. When I was in I mean, some of these are very personal, some of them are cultural. I don't know if this is the best example, but not, probably not an example at all, but it occurs to me. Many years ago, I was at a panel of two people, and I was the Buddhist priest. I was a Zen priest, and so I was the Buddhist priest. And then there was this Christian minister, and we were supposed to talk about what brought us to our respective vocations. And I started off, and I talked about how what brought me to my then Zen practice, to Buddhist practice, was I found it to be the most the most satisfying or deepest form of self-expression that I'd known in my life until that point. That somehow when I sat in meditation, it was a form of self-expression in the way an artist would maybe express herself on a canvas or in sculpture. So for me, sitting in meditation was a form of self-expression more than a form of self-discovery. That you let go of all the other, all the preoccupations, all the extra stuff, all the inhibitions and fears that kind of get in the way of some deeper self-expression arising. And then that self-expression comes up and there can be a feeling of great freedom. So for me, that's what brought me to practice and kept me practicing was this connection with some very deep core sense of freedom, of self-expression. So the minister who was next to me, it was her turn to speak. And as she was speaking, I was kind of amazed that how different it was. It was like almost the opposite. For her, what had brought her into her Christian faith and her Christian calling was a sense of community. For me, it was very individual, it was very personal. It had nothing to do with community in a sense, but for her, it was all about community. Nothing about herself. Nothing about her, discovering herself or what was inside. It was a sense of being connected to this community of heartfelt people. And it struck me, it's two different, in a sense, worldviews, with two different ways of seeing the world. And sometimes it's very difficult to see how we're attached to our worldview. The story I've told sometimes is another place where I was shocked by this. When I was in a monastery in Japan, and every morning we had to do a temple cleaning. It was almost like a ritual where everyone had to clean for about 15 minutes together. It had to be done very vigorously to kind of show everyone that you were wholehearted, 105%, into the cleaning, and your whole body, your mind, everything was engaged. And it didn't really matter if it needed to be cleaned or not. You were supposed to just clean. It's like you have to rake the leaves off the paths. Even if there's no leaves there, you just have to rake. It was a ritual. It was, you had to do it. And so I was often assigned to the ceremonial hall, and there were all these pillars in the hall, and we had these wet cloths, so we had to kind of dust them down every day. They were the most clean columns in the world. Because there wasn't, there were 10 of us cleaning this hall, and there wasn't that much to do after a while. 15 minutes, we kind of did the, And so we would often be repeating things. So I'd clean a column, someone would come right behind me and clean the same column. And so I was engaged with these 10 guys, kind of doing this cleaning for over many days, same thing over and over again. So sometimes when you do the same thing over and over again, you can notice perhaps something not obvious the first 2, 3, 10 times. And suddenly one day, in the middle of it, I kind of woke up. It was kind of a feeling of waking up, kind of. Suddenly, it dawned on me. I was living in a different universe than these other guys. Different worldview, different social universe. I was cleaning the hall as an individual among a group of other individuals. They were cleaning the hall as a group. They were walking. They were cleaning, going around the hall, cleaning, very tuned in to where everyone else was, and they were doing it kind of like a dance as a group together, like this group mind operating. And I was doing it as an individual. There were two radical different worldviews, cultural views of what an individual is, coming into play. I had come from this Western individualistic worldview, And they had come from a Japanese view where the group, the social group, is actually has greater prominence than the individual. That who you are as an individual is defined by the group, which is not something Americans would like to admit very often. In America, that you define yourself. Self-made person is the American dream for some people. And at that moment, I didn't have a feeling that one was better than the other, one was, you know, more right than the other. I thought they were both valid in their own way, but I was really struck by how radically different they were, and that both were valid, and how it had been invisible to me, the paradigm that I'd been working under when I was in the West. So I say all this as an example that our attachments are very difficult sometimes to see, because we can be attached to a whole worldview that we haven't even noticed yet. We're attached to things being a certain way, and the way they are is often this paradigm of cultural understanding what it means to be an individual. And we don't want that threatened, because to have that threatened means that our sense of self gets threatened. But the clinging to a sense of self is one of these arrows that adds second level of suffering on top of what goes on in life. And you see that with a national crisis, the degree to which people want national pride is at stake. You saw it very explicitly during the Gulf War, where people are very happy about the Gulf War, some people were, because it was reasserting American pride. American pride had been destroyed in Vietnam, where we lost this war and a number of things after that, and finally America was, national pride was reinstated. And it was a pride thing. I was horrified when I heard these kinds of statements to justify war on issues of personal identity like pride. But I think often these kinds of national crises touch a nerve for people in their self-identity. And one of the things people are protecting is their sense of self, and then radiating out from that all they think they need in order to maintain that sense of self. So the suffering, the arising of suffering, and the overcoming of suffering, the ending of suffering, the ceasing of suffering. What the Buddha claimed is it's possible to remove the second arrow, to remove this arrow from our hearts, and to live a life of peace, to live at least without any inner conflict within us. It's not easy to do that, and so the Buddha then taught the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path lays out a number of different practices and approaches that he said are helpful or supportive for this process of letting go of the causes of suffering, for ending them. So just simply say there's suffering, there's a cause of suffering in desire, and there's a possibility to end suffering by letting go of this compulsive desire is almost too simplistic. Sometimes it's so simplistic it just can be like adding salt to your wounds, because it makes it sound like it's so simple. But the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, then becomes really crucial. Because it's not easy to do this. It's very important to start living a life which is supportive for the possibility of doing this. To develop the right understanding, to develop the right intention, to have the right kind of speech. Speech is very important for the level of your suffering. To develop the right kind of action, to live a moral life. To have the right kind of livelihood, to have a livelihood which doesn't cause greater harm to the planet than to others. And to practice effortfully, to make an effort. Don't expect your inner life to change by magic, that somehow or other things are going to change for the better. You have to apply yourself. And then practice of mindfulness and the practice of concentration. And these things, can seem like a daunting task to undertake, but to engage with them slowly, bit by bit, every day to engage in small way with them, let them grow over time. They bring tremendous fruit. And over time doesn't mean, so you don't look at what the benefits are in a matter of, one day or 1 week or one retreat. But you look over what benefits over a year, 2 years, 10 years. 2 years will pass very quickly. And to sit every day and practice every day and have that momentum building over 2 years, in 2 years there'll be a great change. So the Eightfold Path allows for slow and slow change. It's like if you do something like yoga practice and your hamstrings are incredibly tight, it will never stretch out. But in fact, you know, there's something like a hundredth of a millimeter stretch, you know, each time you do it. And if you do it, you know, every day, then for a year, then you get 3 millimeters difference. And that's a big difference for your hamstrings, perhaps. So in the same way, so that with enough drops, the bathtub is filled. So the Four Noble Truths. So in a sense, the usual way of understanding the Four Noble Truths is that they focus on the individual, in ending the war and the conflict in the hearts of each person, pulling out the arrows in each person. We need some people to do that. As Thich Nhat Hanh writes so well, the boat people said that every time their small boats were caught in storms, they knew their lives were in danger. But if one person on the boat could keep calm and not panic, that was a great help for everyone. People could listen to him or her and keep serene, and there was a chance for the boat to survive the danger. Our earth is like a small boat. Compared with the rest of the cosmos, it is a very small boat, and it is in danger of sinking. We need such a person to inspire us with calm confidence, to tell us what to do. Who is that person? The Buddhist sutras tell us that you are that person. If you yourself, if you are your best, then you are that person. Only with such a person, calm, lucid, aware, will our situation improve. I wish you good luck. Please be yourself. Please be that person. So that's probably a good ending of the talk. But I'd like to have a little appendix to the talk. So the Four Noble Truths are usually understood to be to address the individual, what the arrows in the individual heart, and how to address that and deal with that. That's very important to do that. But the wording of the Four Noble Truths, there's no pronoun to them. It doesn't say your suffering or my suffering. It's just simply suffering is there in the world. There's a cause for suffering. There's a possibility to end the suffering, and there's a path for ending it. The Four Noble Truths are wonderful categories, frameworks, to apply to the external world also. There's suffering out there in the world. What is the cause of that suffering? What is the attachment and desire that's a cause of the suffering in Afghanistan? Is it possible to end that suffering by understanding what those causes are? And is there a path for bringing the end of that suffering? So, I see that the mindfulness practice the mindfulness practice in the Buddhist tradition uses the Four Noble Truths, these four categories, as a framework for helping us understand our present moment experience. Whether that present moment experience is in our own hearts or halfway around the world, we can use these categories, not as kind of philosophical truths, but as a kind of a useful categories of exploration, discovery. Where is the suffering? Can we then understand the cause of that suffering? Can we understand the thirst or the compulsion that resides ultimately at its origins in individual people's hearts? And then can we address that? So may each of you discover whatever arrows are in your own hearts and meet it with great compassion, generosity, and love. And in doing that, perhaps extract it. Thank you.